been chatting with a few of you. I'm thrilled to have you attend and participate in our discussions. This is the last class for everyone except the students. A reminder to the students, your papers are due on November 30th, and we'll talk about those papers during class on the 30th. So today, we're going to talk about interstate water management and a little bit of international water management. And remember, the whole theme this fall has been throwing politics into it to a degree. And I have a great story at the end that I want to tell you about how politics actually helped in getting an agreement among states and nations. So with that, I'm going to share my screen. I won't be paying attention to the chat box. So if you need to interrupt me, that's probably the best thing to do. There we go. Oops. Sorry, my buttons keep moving around here. Can y'all see that? Anybody?
Yeah, yes? I can see it. Can you make it full screen? There you go.
There we go. Now I just have to go back to the front. Okay, there we go. I'm going to turn my camera off because we usually get better reception when I do that. Well, maybe not, because I don't know how to go back there. So, okay. And I have the wrong screen on, so let me go back. Sorry, people. Let me try again. That's the one I want. There we go. Okay. Apologies. So we're talking today about interstate and international water management, and that's done through a whole host of different ways. In the West, remember, this is the prior appropriation system, and I don't know if I mentioned this at the first class, but all of the states come into the Union owning their own water and having the rights to that water within the state. And so that put us all on equal footing. But we have interstate streams that run through several states, and we started to see controversies over sharing those rivers. Come on. Okay, there we go. I always like this one because sometimes those controversies, like say Arkansas or Kansas and Colorado or Wyoming and Montana, are sovereigns just going at it, trying to share a common resource. So in order to take care of those disputes, we turn to the Constitution. And that gives us several ways to look at how to solve disputes. So you can have direct legislation by Congress to tell us how to divide the water between or among the states. States originally worked at filing what's called original actions in the United States Supreme Court under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. This is what happened in the early 1900s, and I'm going to go through an example with respect to that. an original action in the Supreme Court means that you don't have to go to a local court and then a regional court and then a state court before you can go to the Supreme Court. You can go straight to the Supreme Court. Two states can ask the Supreme Court to resolve their differences. The way the Supreme Court, so the Supreme Court is the trial court. And how they do that is they usually appoint what's called a special master who acts as the trial judge, who listens to arguments on both sides, who prepares what he thinks is the proper decision, and then gives that to the parties and to the Supreme Court. And then the parties take exceptions to those decisions, and then they argue in front of the Supreme Court. Colorado has been in front of the Supreme Court several times, and we'll talk about some of those along the way here. The final way to resolve controversies between states is to have a compact between states. This is under the Compact Clause, which is Article 1, Section 10 in the Constitution. And this I'll come to that too in a minute. So that's the three different ways you can resolve disputes among states. Now, remember this diagram. I showed it to you the first night. Kevin Ryan, the state engineer, showed it to you again. We fondly call this the snake diagram, but it maps out all the different interstate rivers that we have. Two-thirds of the water generated in Colorado goes out of state. And we have compacts or court decrees that govern the division of those rivers. The big ones are the Arkansas, the Platte River, Yampa, Colorado River, the Gunnison, Rio Grande, and Dolores. I'm going to spend a little time, more time at the end, talking about Colorado River issues. But this just shows the magnitude of what we're dealing with. So here's an example. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a river, the Laramie River, and on it we had Colorado and Wyoming users pulling out of the river. Now, Wyoming had a senior water right that was pulling the river, and Colorado had some irrigation rights that wanted to pull some out of the Laramie River. And it would substantially decrease the river. So the water users in Wyoming said, no, we're the senior, you don't get to do that. Colorado said, screw you, this is our water, we can do it. So Wyoming filed a Supreme Court action, original court action, in 1911 over the Laramie River. Now, this had not happened before. The court had not seen an interstate dispute on water. They'd done a lot of land disputes and border disputes, but nothing on water. So they had nothing really to fall back on to make a decision as to who prevails here. The Supreme Court looked at the Western water law, looked at prior appropriation, saw that both Colorado and Wyoming had adopted the doctrine of prior appropriation. And the Supreme Court used that then to divide the water, saying that Wyoming had the senior right, the senior gets that right, and can call out the junior user when there's not enough water in the river. That was Wyoming versus Colorado, the Laramie River decree, issued finally in 1922. The other decree that controls the river is Nebraska v. Wyoming, the North Platte decree in 1945. Argument was the same. Nebraska was senior, Wyoming and Colorado were junior, and Nebraska won on that, again, under the auspices of the prior appropriation doctrine. Well, this started concerning Colorado folks, looking at how the Supreme Court was making these decisions. And so we had all these interstate rivers. We were worried about how other states might develop faster than we would. And so we had a master of law. His name was Delph Carpenter. And he decided, he looked at the compact, he looked at the Constitution, and he saw the compact clause. And he then advocated to other states, to first Colorado and then to other states, that rather than fighting this out in the Supreme Court, we should come to an agreement among ourselves. And the thing about the compact clause is that you also have to have the agreement of the federal government and of the legislature. So this is a picture of a book by Dan Tyler. I highly recommend it. Dan's a great writer and he's a good storyteller. And this talks about how Delph Carpenter came to his notions, how he fought for them, and how he negotiated many of the compacts that we have in Colorado. So the compacts we do have are 1922 Colorado River Compact, the La Plata, the South Platte, Rio Grande, Republican, Castilla Creek, Upper Colorado, Arkansas, and the Animas La Plata Compact. So there are nine compacts that govern how we share our interstate water. So some elements of compacts are a little different for each entity and for each river. All of the compacts have to be approved by the state legislatures and Congress. So a compact is both a state law and a federal law. There are different ways they divide the river, some by percent of the flow, that's the Rio Grande Compact, some by a delivery requirement by an upper basin state, and the Colorado River Compact, which is by a non-use requirement. Many compacts have administrative bodies. They're called compact commissions that are supported by the Bureau of Reclamation and USGS. And they essentially, it's not so much that they actually administer the river, but they keep track and they keep track of who's using what, how much has left the state, how much has been delivered to the next state. Then, if you have a compact and you've got a dispute over whether or not a state is honoring that compact, you go back to the Supreme Court. And that's an original jurisdiction with a special master appointed. Two of the disputes in our most recent past are Kansas v. Colorado, which was an well interference of the Arkansas compact deliveries. Kansas said Colorado was sucking up the water through their wells and not accounting for it. And then Kansas versus Nebraska and Colorado on the Republican River. Again, it's a well interference case. There's also a case now on the Rio Grande that Colorado is involved in, but the dispute is really mostly between New Mexico and Texas. Again, Texas is saying that New Mexico wells are sucking up too much water and that New Mexico is not meeting its deliveries under the Rio Grande Compact. So how do compacts affect in-state administration? Kevin Ryan mentioned this, but it was kind of in passing. So I wanted to come back to that because it's very important to understand how those compacts affect our internal state water rights. Here's another line diagram. This would be the La Plata River. where we had a senior in Colorado who was taking water out of the river, and we had a junior in New Mexico who also wanted water out of the river. The La Plata didn't have enough water to deliver to New Mexico what's required under the compact. And so the state engineer, whose name was Hinderleiter, shut down the senior water right. He was taken to court, the water court, and then the water court, and then the Supreme Court, Colorado Supreme Court, held that the senior right could do that, that the Hinderleiter had no right to shut down the senior so that juniors across the state line could get that water. Hinderleiter took that case to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that, yes, the state engineer does have the authority to curtail water rights when necessary to comply with compacts and decrees. And in Colorado, curtailment is an everyday occurrence on most rivers. So we're used to that, but it's still a factor in what the state engineer and division engineers look at when they're trying to make sure that we're making our deliveries, so-called deliveries to under the compacts. Colorado is untested. If you read the news and keep up on water issues, that's a conversation that the state of Colorado is having right now. There's no question that the state engineer could curtail water rights if we are not meeting our compact delivery requirements. They're not really delivery requirements, but if we're not meeting our obligations under the compact. The question that's arising is, can the state engineer curtail water rights so that we don't miss out on our obligations? And I'll explain the Colorado River here in a minute, and we'll go into that. So the Hinderleiter case is very important. It tells us that state water rights essentially are subservient to the interstate compacts and decrees.
Jennifer, can I ask a question?
Yeah, I'm just going to stop here and see if there were questions. Go ahead.
Was the compact senior to the senior water right?
No, because almost all compacts have clauses in them that senior water rights are not affected.
Well, so in this case, they're saying that you couldn't.
In this case, he was senior to the New Mexico water right downstream, but he was not senior to the compact itself.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. That's a great question.
I have a question too.
Go ahead.
Similarly, I mean, on the Rio Grande, when the compact, came in, it's not spoken about very often this way, but it kind of became the number one water right. Because Colorado fell way behind on its deliveries to New Mexico, and due to some clauses in the compact, where it's able to make that up. But so we do, the Rio Grande does curtail, and I'm sure you know this, Jim, the Rio Grande does curtail in order to meet, as based on projections throughout the summer, they curtail the most junior water rights, but they work their way up the line to meet the compact obligation.
That's correct. It happens also on the Platte River. It happens on the La Plata. Like I said, the Colorado River is kind of an iffy thing. Oh. It happens on the Laramie.
Okay. So I'm sorry. You were probably talking specifically about the Colorado. So.
No, that's fine. That clarifies it. Any other questions before I move on?
I have a question.
Sure.
It's kind of a two-part question. So water rights are administered via like CFS or like an amount, and those amounts are not changed with changing hydrology?
No. Okay. Those amounts, because of our prior appropriation system, the amounts stay the same. How much you get of that, though, depends on what's in the river and whether you're a senior or junior.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, you have to forgive me. I get so into this, I just get rolling. So stop it. What I want to do now is the Colorado River is kind of the big talking points in the state of Colorado in the other six basin states. And it's an interesting study as to interstate management and how United States Supreme Court decree essentially divided the lower basin of the river and how we are managing it now during the drought. If you'll recall this map here, this is the Colorado River Basin. The basin is has seven states, two nations, United States and Mexico. It's 2,500 square miles of drainage, provides water to 40 million people, 5.5 million acres of irrigated agriculture, and it serves the served area has an economic value of $1.4 trillion annually. And one thing that Brad pointed out, and I want to point out too, if you see these hatched areas here and here, most of the population served by the Colorado River is out of the basin. So you have the Denver area here, you have Colorado Springs, you've got Albuquerque and Santa Fe, we've got Salt Lake, and then of course, Los Angeles and San Diego, way off the basin. So when Delph Carpenter was representing Colorado in Wyoming versus Colorado on the Laramie River, and when he saw where the court was headed with respect to using the prior appropriation doctrine between states, he kept looking at California and thinking, oh my God, look how fast they're growing. If they're the first to use the water, they're going to have the best claim on this water. And so he convinced the other states and the federal government to come together and hammer out a compact that would divide the water among the seven basin states. That water, they met, it took them, 10 days a week. They met in Santa Fe out of the basin, and they just stayed at it until they could reach some sort of agreement. And all of those proceedings can be found on the internet, or can be found in archives. We have them, Patty Reddick has them here at CSU. They're very interesting reading, and they give us some insight as to what these folks were thinking at the time. So it was too difficult to divide the river up among the states. They could not come to any sort of solid agreement. So what they did was they divided the Colorado River between the upper basin and the lower basin, the upper basin division states are Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico. The lower division states are California, Arizona, and Nevada. And this map shows you that essentially we divided up the river, 7.5 million acre feet per year to the upper basin and 7.5 to the lower basin. And then an additional 1 million acre feet was given to the lower basin because of the Gila River. And so they get 8.5 million acre feet. At the time, the average flows for the Colorado River were thought to be about 17, 18 million acre feet a year. Mexico then also under a treaty gets 1.5 million acre feet. So again, we didn't, so we have the upper basin, lower basin. The dividing point is Lee Ferry. And then at this point, they developed Hoover Dam, which was to be the dam that was the holding pot for delivery of water to the lower basin. Later on, Lake Powell was put in place. Lake Powell is essentially a savings account for the upper basin to make sure that we meet our obligations and make sure the water that goes supposed to go to the lower basin does go to the lower basin. This is the treaty. By the way, the treaty is also Rio Grande and the Tijuana River. It requires Mexico or United States to deliver 1.5 million acre feet to Mexico. And that water, that's the senior right of the Colorado River. That water has to be delivered first before the rest of the water in the river is split up. On the Rio Grande, it's mostly delivery requirements by Mexico to the United States. So in 2012, the Bureau of Reclamation did a study looking at how much water is in the river and what we think the projected demand is going to be. And here's what happened. It's obvious that demand was going beyond the supply, and it was just going to get worse. This chart is a bit deceptive, and I'm always hesitant in using it because part of what this shows is the lower basin was using more than what it's allowed, what it's entitled to under the compact. But the way the compact reads is the upper basin cannot not let the water flow downhill if they're not using it. And so the lower basin depended on good flows that happened until the drought hit. And then we had to start, they had to start ratcheting back to their compact entitlement. So there's, this chart is the latest one that just came out this month on inflows to Lake Powell. In other words, looking at how much water is running in the river at Lee Ferry with adjustments being made. And you can see the average from 1981 to 2010 has been 10.83 million acre feet. Now recall, when they negotiated the compact, it was 16 or 17 million acre feet as an average. And there have been lots of ups and downs, the biggest down being the drought that started at 2001, 2002. We had a great year in 2011. We're having a terrible year now. I mean, you heard Brad Udall talk about the fact that we had 100% snowpack last spring, but only 50% runoff. And so these factors of drought and dry soil have really affected how much water we have in the river. These are pictures of Lake Powell during the drought, with the drought, and Lake Mead. So Brad talked about the fact, the study that he did in 2017, where they predicted that about 20% reduction of Colorado River flows have happened from 2000 to 2014. And he talked about the decline, that a third of the decline was from higher upper basin temperatures. His later study says that that's 50% of the decline is from higher temperatures and from the change in stream flow patterns. And so they predicted that it could be a 35% reduction in flows by the end of the century if we keep going like we're going. Well, this was a wake-up call to all the states, and especially the Bureau of Reclamation and the Department of Interior. The Department of Interior, I'm going to go back here because I missed something. So we talked about the fact that we have Lake Mead, and that is, I'm pointing at my screen and now I realize I have a cursor. We're at Lake Mead, and that's the bucket that holds the water for the lower basin. Under contracts with the Bureau of Reclamation, water users receive their water from that bucket. So the Bureau of Reclamation essentially is a water master for the lower basin. Also the lower basin then ended up with the Supreme Court deciding how much water it would divvy up among the states. And the Supreme Court relied on the legislation that authorized Hoover Dam that said the water would be split with 4.4 million acre feet to California, 2.8 million acre feet to Arizona, and 300,000 acre feet to Nevada. The upper basin came to an agreement in 1948 with respect to how much water they're going to get among themselves, with 51.25% to Colorado, 23% to Utah, 14% to Wyoming, and 11.25% to New Mexico. The upper basin states are not controlled by the Bureau of Reclamation and the Department of Interior. There are dams run by the Bureau of Reclamation that are Colorado River Storage Project Act dams and reservoirs, and those help to hold water in them in order to allow the upper basin to meet its obligations under the compact. So water that's not being used in the upper basin flows to Lake Powell. Lake Powell is our bank account. And then that bank account we use to make sure that the lower basin receives the water that is allowed under the compact. I'm going to stop there. Are there any questions? Okay. So the drought hit. And the Secretary of Interior, who controls reclamation, who controlled all the dams on the river, turned to the states and said, the way we're operating this river right now is not going to work. We have to figure out a better way. And this was Secretary Gail Norton, who was Attorney General in Wyoming also. And she looked at the states and said, you figure this out, you figure out a better way for us to operate the river, or we're going to do it for you. Well, nobody wants the federal government running their water in their river. And so the states, after I think about 18 months of brutal negotiations, figured out an alternative. And these now are called the Interstate Cooperation 2007 Interim Guidelines. And what those guidelines did, it set criteria for shortages in the lower basin. It looked at Lake Mead and said, if Lake Mead is at a certain level, then shortages will have to be taken by the states of Arizona and Nevada. And those are set out in a chart. It also, though, created a mechanism for the lower basin to bank water and water they had conserved, and that was called intentionally created surplus. The point for that was to keep the levels in Mead higher so they wouldn't be hitting those lines where shortages would be declared. And then they figured out a way of what they call coordinating criteria for operations between Powell and Meade. And that balanced the reservoirs essentially to be fair to both the lower basin and the upper basin. And again, it was a protection to make sure that upper basin met its obligations under the compact. That wasn't enough. And we had to go back and plan some more. And there was another ultimatum issued by Secretary Sally Jewell to the states saying, okay, the criteria, the interim criteria were a good start, but we've got to do more. And she turned to the states and asked them to figure out how to work it even more. So this put the states into something called contingency planning. In the upper basin, these plans look at protecting critical elevations in Lake Powell, talking about demand management on a voluntary temporary program to reduce consumptive uses, and weather modification. In the lower basin, it was more strict measures to declare shortages. And in fact, Arizona, I think last year, or maybe this year, took a shortage. But it did allow some new flexibility in storing conserved water. I think I'm gonna leave that there at that. So, Here's the story I love to tell. When the states and the United States met and to come up with the interim guidelines, they assumed Mexico was also going to participate in sharing shortages on the river. Mexico was not at the table. Then there came some other issues between, in fact, relationships between Mexico and the United States on the Colorado River were strained, where they were very strained. There were salinity issues. Mexico was complaining that the United States was delivering too salty of water to Mexico. There was a dispute on the lining of the All-American Canal. Lining that All-American Canal in California kept water from draining into the ground, and that was water then that would be used by farmers in Mexico. And then the interim guidelines, and Mexico said, you know, what's going on, guys? We didn't agree to anything about sharing shortages. And that's when we started negotiations for minutes 319. And I was very fortunate to be a part of that negotiation team when I was director of CWCB. It was a rough start. First of all, when two nations negotiate for an agreement, it's just the nations at the table. It's just the United States and it's just Mexico. Well, in Mexico, the water is controlled by the federal government. In the United States, the water is controlled by the states. So the United States could make no agreement about water that belonged to the states. And it was very difficult. I spent the first negotiation session in a conference room in Southern Nevada Water Authority's office building, off to the side while Mexico and the United States were supposedly negotiating. And then they were supposed to come in and consult with the states. Well, they never came in, and we spent the whole day waiting. So that was a rough start. And it was just protocol. It was protocol by both states' departments that you only have the two nations sitting at the table. Well, that wasn't getting us anywhere. And in this picture, in both these pictures, this is Commissioner Simón, who is the Mexican commissioner. And we have Commissioner, Drusina, who was United States commissioner, sat down, went to their superiors, went to the State Departments and said, this isn't working. We have to let the states come in and sit at the table. They pushed this so hard that Commissioner Simón probably was close to getting fired when he pushed this, but he pushed it. They agreed to let the states come to the table. The states came to the table and we were able then to proceed with negotiations. Now, the interesting thing, well, let me back up. One other thing that happens during these negotiations, and let me stop. Minutes to the treaty are not amendments to the treaty, but they're agreements on how to operate under the treaty. So that's why it's called Minute 319 and 223. So, negotiations stalled. Then, in Easter of 20, let's see, when was that? Earthquake. There was a serious earthquake in Mexico, Easter Sunday of 2010, and it wiped out some of the delivery channels to the Mexican entities. That allowed us to start looking at how to deal with Lake Mead and maybe storing Mexico's water in Lake Mead until they could fix those canals and use that water. And that opened up another round of negotiations that was led then to 319. In the summer of 2012, so it was 2 years later, we had another stall. And there was concern because the Mexican president was going to change. And the Mexican elections were in July. The president didn't take over, though, until the new year. And with these negotiations, as particular and precise and as they were, everyone was worried that if we had a new president, we'd have a new administration in Mexico, and we'd have to start from scratch. And we wanted to get this done before the change in administration. Also, as it turned out, United States 2012 is going to have a change of administrations. And again, we didn't want to start from scratch. So that helped us over that little bit of rough edge. And we were able then to come to an agreement. And Minute 319 was signed in November of 2012. And then I also have Minute 323. Minute 319 expired in 2017. It was five years. And we needed to go beyond that. And of course, the drought was still worsening. So they sat down and negotiated something similar and a little more broad with Minute 323. And again, politics played a role here. This negotiation went on for over a year. And when it stalled, it was not looking good. And so the parties came together in November of 2016, and they were scheduled for 2 days of negotiations. The first day was the United States presidential election. Now, as you recall, President Trump had a lot of rhetoric about Mexico and Mexicans, and there was a concern that if Trump were to be elected, this could fall through. Well, Trump was elected. The next day, both parties came to the table and they were able to come to an agreement. And that's minute 323. Again, Mexico sharing shortages on the river with the rest of us. So that's my story. I love that story. And I apologize for dwelling on it too long. But I'm going to stop my screen share and come back. Oh, I guess I was always on camera. And see if there are any comments, questions. A reminder that all of these lectures have been recorded and you can find them on the website under Grad 592. And I'll stop there.
This is John Yelling.
John, go ahead.
I'm wondering, why weren't the Indian nations, who have the most senior water rights, ever involved in the negotiations?
Good question. Under Arizona v. California, the United States Supreme Court case, the Indian tribes' piece of the river comes out of their state's apportionment. So in Colorado, when we settled with the Utes, the Mountain Utes and the Southern Utes, whatever water they use comes out of our piece of the river under the compact. And the question, that's a great question, and tribes asked us that question, and we did not have a good answer for it. I do know that tribes are more involved with the discussions on 323, and they're also they will be more involved with the discussions on the replacement of the critical of the 2007 interim guidelines, which are being renegotiated now. The interim guidelines end in 2026. And so the states and federal government are gearing up for that and are making it a point to include Indians and a broader scope of folks in those discussions.
Thank you.
Other questions? Ed, you talked about Arizona's lawyers wrote a paper on the interim guidelines where they apparently demanded 9 million acre feet releases from Powell in low reservoir operations and threatened litigation. 9 million acre feet. Remember, I have not seen that paper, Ed, so I'd have to look at it. But how do I say this? Arizona is an interesting state to negotiate with. And they have their own internal issues. But the 9.0 comes from 7.5 acre feet, essentially, out of that they get out of Lake Mead. But in the lower basin, losses in the river, delivery losses and evaporation from the reservoir are not counted. And so they've really been getting about 9 million acre feet a year this whole time. And they wanted to keep that going. And it's what we call this structural deficit, because that means they're using 1.5 million acre feet more than what they're supposed to be using. But I think that issue is going to be dealt with and definitely talked about as they renegotiate the 2007 guidelines. I hope that helps, Ed.
So I had a question.
Hi, Rio. Go ahead.
Back to circling back a little bit to the tribal water rights. I've seen some pretty big numbers of tribal water ownership. What if, like, say, I'm thinking probably Arizona, if they develop all the water that's available and then the tribes go through the courts and, or whatever process and get the rights to their water, there's not there probably won't be enough water. It's kind of a general state.
That's a concern. That is a concern. Arizona, like I said, Colorado's worked it out. New Mexico, I think, has worked out most of their issues. Arizona is the big what if. And those rights haven't been adjudicated. But even if the rights are adjudicated, they have to be using them. And to use them, they have to have some kind of development going on. And so as an immediate concern, it's not, but it's always there in the back of everybody's mind.
Because it seems like there's a bigger amount of water than or rights, as is always the case, than there is actual.
Always the case, right.
So, great. Thank you. That's helpful.
You're welcome. Anyone else?
I have a question. So you had mentioned that there was some issues with salinity with the water that Mexico was receiving. Is there anything built into this that focuses on like water quality, or how is that dealt with?
So salinity issues with Mexico have been, that has been an issue since the treaty was signed. And in the 1970s, a new minute was, a new agreement came to, and it was Minute 242. And it set the standards, the salinity standards, for what the United States was required to deliver to Mexico. However, they never agreed on how those measurements, and the issue kept festering. But both 319 and 323 tried to address those issues. And the big win on that one was we finally started using the same technical platform to determine the numbers, so that we weren't saying, yes, we've met it, and Mexico saying, no, you didn't. By our numbers, you didn't. And yes, that's still being watched over. In fact, we have a desalting plant in Yuma that reclamation built to help with those salinity issues, never really got off the ground. It still does a little few things here and there. Thanks for picking up on that, Natalie.
Can I comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I used to go down to take an irrigation tour down, stopped at Yuma, and looked at the Walton Mohawk Project, which was a Soil Conservation Service, Natural Resource Conservation Project, to improve irrigation quality and keep the salt out of the return flow, because the Gila River underlying that is a very, very salty thing. This is when they put in that desalinization plant. Has it ever been used?
It has been used, but it hasn't ever been used to full throttle.
Because they did.
And then it was set down for a while.
Of dead leveling some big fields, putting a lot of water on there to increase the efficiency, primarily to cut out that salinity.
Yes, it's a very expensive plant to run.
I estimated $700 an acre foot.
That's probably about right. I don't recall.
That's 20 years old too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a very expensive proposition. Okay. I want to mute back.
Okay. Thanks, Dick. Anyone else?
I have a quick question for you, Jennifer. So out of the two international treaties and the interstate compacts that you mentioned, I noticed that they all cover surface water, but do any of them touch on groundwater?
No. And that's part of the problem that we're seeing developing in the controversies that are occurring with compacts all over the West. Groundwater is not part of the compact. And then each state defines groundwater a little differently. For instance, here in Colorado, our groundwater is, the groundwater that's connected to the river is administered as any other river right. That's not so in other states necessarily. So that's a complicating factor.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, Jennifer. I have a question.
Sure, Daniel. Go ahead.
I'm trying to think of how to ask this. So in Colorado, like, we have river commissioners and division engineers and like a whole division of water resources to manage and operate our rivers. Who, like, what does that look like on a nation and international, like, level? Because I understand it very clearly, like, in our state, but I guess it's really hard for me to comprehend, like, what does a call look like at the state level or the interstate level, I guess?
Well, on the interstate level, we have these compact commissions, but they, like I said, they mostly, the Colorado River, the Upper Colorado River Compact Commission is authorized to determine how much each state has to give into the river if we aren't meeting our compact obligations, but they've never had to do that. And most of the commissions on these interstate rivers are like that. They collect data, they share data, they talk among each other, they argue about whether one state's in compliance or not, and if it gets bad enough, then they go to the Supreme Court. On the border, and I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to mention, we have something called the International Boundary and Water Commission. This was created by the treaty, and it's a binational commission. It has a Mexican side and it has the United States side. And those two commissioners, pictures who I showed, are the ones who then control what goes on at the border with respect to water delivery. They work very closely with Bureau of Reclamation because Reclamation is the one that actually puts that water in the river and delivers it to Mexico. There are some international, I'm trying to think it, I think it's in the Middle East where you have some water commissions that are actually act like our water commissioners where they're turning water on and off. Here, it's usually the federal government that has control. They report what they're doing. And under the compact, if there's a call, for instance, if New Mexico says to Colorado, you're not meeting your delivery requirements, then Colorado has to respond. And that's usually, as Rio said, we're usually shutting people off before we have to respond to make sure that we meet that compact. So it's different in each river and between nations, but that's kind of an idea of how it goes.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Jennifer, I'm thinking about, probably long after the compacts were written and all that, more information and negotiations start, including river flows and species and riparian health and things like that. What are some of the big changes that have come forward to in these later negotiations that have benefited those parts of the rivers?
Well, the environment has definitely benefited. That was one of the reasons Mexico came to the table in Minute 319, is they wanted to improve the riverine environment in Mexico. And in fact, we had an experimental flow of water that left the United States, and there was what's called a pulse flow, and it just pulsed down into Mexico and actually met the Sea of Cortez. So that was exciting for everyone. And there are wonderful pictures about how the vegetation that sprouted and all of that. So I think it's the environment and the fact that we have to pay attention to Native Americans too. Recreational interests, I think, are there and their voice is heard. It's just not as loud as some of the others.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us and this fall. I'll wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. I hope you stay healthy and away from the virus. And to the students, I'll see you on November 30th. Have a good break. Goodbye.
Bye, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. No.
know, I think